an interview of Mr. and Mrs. Horace Moose, who are ranchers in the Palito Blanco area. The interview was held on July 4th, 1973. The interviewer is William F. Augustine.
And pretty feeble most of the time. Pardon me.
Well, go ahead.
You were talking about Palito Blanco?
Yes, this village, it used to be called Eva. And up the country there somewhere, there's a place named Era. E-R-A. If you know, a lot of people make a V and an R a great deal the same way. And a lot of times our mail would go to Era and they would come here, so they changed it to Palito Blanco. And when they changed it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can remember we had a post office there, and the mail came three times a week to it.
Mm-hmm. Must have been in the late 20s.
And they must have changed the name, back in the late teens or 20s to Palito Blanco, and we used that for a long time. And then finally they did away with the little post office, and we got rural delivery, you see, mail carrier.
Nice.
And you hardly ever hear of Palito Blanco anymore, but that's what still goes by that name. What I mean, if you send a letter out on anyone out here, you'd say Alice, Texas, Route 1, and so on and so forth. And what I started to say, this fellow Garza, what his idea was to get these very wealthy people here to back him, money-wise, and to get an army together, which he did after a fashion, and go and invade Mexico with the intention of overthrowing Porfirio Diaz.
What year was this, roughly?
That was in the 90s. I don't know just what year. It was before I was born. I think 92 or 3 or something like that. And I remember when I was a kid, they still had a printing press over there. Of course, it hadn't been used, where he's printing propaganda, you know, to scatter out among the people. And I believe he had 3 different organizations in this area here. Well, I read one book about it, small book, I forget the name of it. Anyhow, they did make one expedition down to across the river there. They shot up a village there, something in the mountain, nothing.
You mean the Rio Grande?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And, at least that's what I've been told, see. Uh-huh. And in the meantime, he married one of these very wealthy Gonzalez's daughters. When Uncle Sam, and of course Uncle Sam at the time was hand in glove in with Mexico, with Porfirio Diaz, that regime, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Porfirio Diaz, as near as I can, history records, invited all nations to come and invest there, you know, to develop the country and in hopes in turn give employment to the people, see? And so in the process, the people as a whole evidently were just held down to starvation wages, you know. I had a man that lived here for 7 years on this place, and that had come out of Mexico. He was considerably older than I. And he said that before the revolution started down there, he says, we actually worked for 5 cents a day in the mines.
Yeah.
He said on Saturdays and Sundays or holidays, we'd go out in the, must have been a mountainous country. I don't think I asked him just what part of Mexico, but he said he's working in the mines. And we'd gather mesquite beans and pear apples and dig roots, anything to exist on. And so this Catarina Garza, his idea, I guess he knew all of that, and his idea was to go down there and get others to join him, of course, and set up a new government, overthrow Porfirio Diaz. And when Uncle Sam heard about it, he sent a bunch of soldiers in here, and one of the interesting things, so I've been told on this creek here, down below, Catarina hid out in a thicket down there somewhere when the soldiers came. And they captured an old fellow that I knew pretty well, of course this was many years later. Mm-hmm. They captured him and put a gun in his back because he knew this old fellow Cadena was one of them, you know, one of Caterina's band, and told him, now, he says, you take us to where Caterina's are or we'll kill you. There was nothing for him to do but lead the way. And so, of course, he wanted to warn Caterina, but how was he going to do it? So when he got right close to where he knew the camp was, where Caterina was hiding out, he turned around to the fellows behind him that he was leading, you know, and, here he is!
Caterina already tore out!
So from there, the story goes that he went to Cuba. Caterina went to Cuba. In the meantime, like I say, he had married one of the Gonzales' girls, and they had one daughter. And from Cuba, he went to Guatemala, and there he was trying to get the army to, with the same intention, see? Uh-huh. Revolution, but his widow, she lived there, I guess she died of old age in Alice, and the daughter married one of the Perises. Pancho Peris. And I believe it's his nephew that owns the land right across the road there, and he's also our district clerk in Alice. Well, but if you could get someone better acquainted with it than I am, I have tried different times of the old timers that knew more about it than I do to write it up. It ought to be interesting. From all accounts, this fellow Garza was a well-meaning man.
Funny Doc did her college thesis on that.
Did she?
For her master's degree, I believe.
Well, anyway, I read a little book of the Caterina Garza Revolution, they called it.
I tell you, somebody he ought to see could probably has a great deal of information on it would be Lawrence.
Carl Duane in Corpus.
He has written two books. One of them fiction, but based on fact, of a little-known battle in the Civil War when Sibley's Rangers went out and tried to catch Santa Fe, New Mexico. And the last book he wrote is a big one, and it takes up a great deal of this area in here because...
He was raised over here.
Carl Duane is what he writes under, and he lives in Corpus, and he... did an awful lot of research in this last one and went back to a bunch of old Spanish records and interpreted them. See, his mother, they lived in this area, and he went back tracing these land grants, you know, a lot in that, and church history. It was quite interesting. He interpreted it from the Spanish.
Well,
tell me something. Not change the subject. Did you and Mrs. Moose, when you got married, settle right here?
Yes.
35 years ago.
35 years
ago?
I was born on this place in a house that later burned down. It was down there about where the hog pens are.
Uh-huh.
And Papa built this house in 1907. An interesting thing about it, I've heard him say that the highest priced lumber in it was $17 a thousand. Uh-huh. And he said, you won't find a knot in a board.
You can't buy lumber like that.
You couldn't buy it at any price like that now.
Uh-huh.
We've remodeled it somewhat. The porch was smaller then, and it wasn't screened
in. And we had it
all. But those, notice those 4x4s there in the corner?
Uh-huh.
They were under the lumber, bracing under the lumber porch here when we built it. And when I put in the cement porch, well, I just used it as a gallery porch. And, little things like that, how things have changed, lumber especially, well, it's just not to be had, good lumber like you could have.
I wish you could have done this while Horace's father was still living. He was 99 years and 4 months old when he died, and he had a wonderful, wonderful memory of the old days in this whole area.
He was a well driller with the old horsepower stuff until about 1903 or 4.
And you go through the country where he used to drill wells, and he could tell you, well, in that hole we hit such and such a formation at so and so many feet.
You see the? Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I just wrote a big paper. When I said big paper, you have to go around checking and talking to people and reading newspapers. And I just did it on the 1915-1916 era. You know, the bandits?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, wait a minute. Along with that, I can tell you something that to me is a lot more impressive than the bandits.
Uh-huh.
Was the drought.
Yeah.
Did they mention that to you?
No. See, now, I went and looked at the newspapers all around here for, 1912 and 1919.
I believe it was the most severe drought I ever saw, but didn't last quite as long as some of the others.
Uh-huh.
Interesting thing, it started in 15, and of course I was only, I was born in 1904, I must have been 11 years of age. And for years my dad here had nothing but purebred red pole bulls on his cattle, always keeping the offspring, you see, into where he had a beautiful herd of red pole cattle. And in the spring of 16, when it began to get so bad, drought, them old cows, they went down pretty bad, getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And so he got pasture for them the other side of San Antonio up there. And he shipped them up there to where there was lots of grass and raining all the time. And when he took them out of here, the neighbors, some of those same Gonzaleses that I mentioned a while ago, they came over and wanted to rent Papa's pasture here. And my dad told him, why, he says, my cattle that are used to the country here, raised on it, he says, they're fixing to die, and he says, there's really nothing for them to eat in there. Well, they said, these are steers, and he says, they're Mexico steers, them old longhorn Mexico steers.
Mm-hmm.
We called them Carrancistas at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nickname given to the Mexican cattle. And he said, they're steers, and they never was used to much to eat, and he says, I think they'll live there. And so they made a deal. I remember Papa was paying 35 cents a month for pasturage up there in grass belly high. And he told them, he says, if you'll pay me the same for them here, he says, you see what it is, how the country looks. He says, with this provision that when it rains good, you got to take them out right away so that my pasture can grow up and I'd want to bring my own cattle back. So they agreed to that, and 3 months later, in July, when it rained a good rain one night, and the next day another, and then a few days later, I guess it was an easterly wave. That time we never heard of an easterly wave, but it rained every day. And so they took their cattle out right away, and you know them blooming old steers had actually put on weight? And Papa's good-blooded, fine cattle that he brought back from up there, they come back just before you shipped them up there. One thing up there, an interesting thing, here, cattle we, up until the last few years, we never put out salt for them or mineral stuff like that.
Huh.
But Papa said when they got up there, he said, the next day the cattle was unsalted. They pastored him with his brother-in-law that also had cattle and kept out salt for his. And he said, the cattle from here, they wanted salt. Some in the grasses, and they wasn't getting, see, or lacking in the grass. And those old Mexican steers had actually put on weight. One thing, shortly after he shipped his cattle up there, the mesquite beans went to ripening, see. We had a good crop of them that year.
Oh.
And that helped a lot. And so another thing up there, Papa said the ticks and flies was horrible, raining so much all the time. And so I know this, I found that out in later years. You move cattle from here to up there, they don't do no good. Mm-hmm. Bring them from there down here and they will. And along that line, like I say, cattle up until, I would say the last 20 years is when more and more we see them using more and more minerals, I guess, which has been leached out of the soil. Mm-hmm. And that grass out there, when you raise a calf on it and you take the calf off and take it somewhere else, you've actually taken out a certain amount of minerals out of the ground, see? And when you do that a long enough period of time, you're bound to deplete it.
Uh-huh.
And so my cattle now, I've tried various different kinds of minerals. A fellow came along a few years ago and he sold me 7 different kinds of minerals. I made a box with 7 different compartments, trying to see what it was that they was really needing, see? And phosphate and salt is the things that they really went for. Phosphorus, I believe it's phosphorus. Anyhow, but salt is the main thing. I've heard it said it's the base of all minerals, and just what they mean by base, I don't know. But anyway, I try to keep out salt for them all the time.
What did you do for your water? You know, as I was looking in this thing I was doing, I took water for granted, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
everybody does, but we don't have enough of it.
Right.
What do you mean, water for drinking or for
the
what?
Cattle, you know? And
or for growing?
For both, because you had to sink wells to live around here, didn't you?
Yes. Well, you see, like I say, my dad was a water well driller. The old horsepower stuff. He spent most of his times out in the camps, you know, where they'd drill a well for somebody, lived in a tent. And an interesting thing he's about in the olden days, this is back in the 90s, mostly west and south of here. Well, he said you'd go out to get your fresh meat. He said you'd just go a little piece and there'd be a deer and you'd kill it. There was no law, you know, you'd kill a doe or a fawn or any time of the year. And I believe he said, at one place there, it must have took them a long time, and no doubt they wasted a lot of the meat. Had to have. They had no icebox and no way to keep them. I believe he said he killed 13, shot them every one in the head. Said, we never thought about shooting at a deer running or any distance. He says, if that one's a little too far off, then it'd run off, go a little further, that'd be another one. And it used to be kind of that way with rabbits here. You'll find this interesting, I'm sure, when I tell you that we three kids, my brother, sister, and I, the first 7 years of our schooling was here at Palito Blanco, and the road went, right by that shed and across the creek right over yonder, and it's about 2 miles. And we went in a one-horse buggy. And a lot of times at mornings we'd amuse ourselves as we jogged along behind that old one-horse pulling the buggy, counting the cottontail rabbits. And more than once we count over 100 in that distance. See, they'd just be sitting around everywhere. And now I can't understand why you seldom see a cottontail. I guess it's been 15 years since I tasted a cottontail. And when I was a kid growing up, it's an important source of fresh meat for them, and I still like a cottontail.
Mm-hmm.
And not long ago we tried a young jackrabbit, but for some reason but the cottontails, we'd kill them like in the evening, and skin them, of course, dress them, and mother would put them in a pan of salt water. You got to bear in mind, of course, we had no ice box, no refrigerator, nothing like that. And next morning, she would take them and roll them in flour and fry them, and I'm telling you that is good eating. And right now, if you could hand me a place a rabbit like that used to be, of course, I probably got a lot hungrier than I do now, or fried chicken, I'd take the rabbit. And I believe it's better for you. You know, chicken is one of the cheapest meats you can buy now, but I can't eat it every day like I used to, like it can be for something like that.
I think we ate too much when we lived here the first 2 years with no refrigeration. And kerosene lamps till 1949 we got our E8. And Horace made me a homemade icebox to keep milk in.
Well, not icebox, cooler.
Took a little, a piece of tin and made two troughs about this deep and about this long and about this wide. And put poles at each four corners. There was a trough at the top, one at the bottom, see, with a shelf in between. And I set my food on that shelf, filled this top compartment with water with a cloth that came down to the bottom, see, and it acted like a wick.
Oh,
and stayed damp
right.
all the time, and it would keep me.
Oh, it helped a lot.
Like a
day.
Desert cooler.
Yeah, right. as the wind blew, you know, and
right.
it would cool it.
But people used to use them a lot. And of course, at the time, kerosene lamps, you know, that was our light. Along that line, I'm sure you'll find this interesting. I believe it was in 1913 when they passed the income tax law.
Yeah.
And like I say, at the time, we got our mail three times a week, and of course, I hadn't even heard of a radio at the time, let alone television. And so Papa subscribed to a newspaper that I believe came twice a week. It was semi-weekly, morning news, or anyway, it was a newspaper that had a wide circulation. And so after supper one night, I could see him yet when he was sitting there reading his paper by kerosene light, of course. And I could see him yet when he looked up and the comment he made, this is very interesting, I thought about it 100 times, more than that, where they had passed the income tax law.
Uh-huh. See?
He had been reading about it and keeping up with it, what is going on, for those kids hadn't. And the comment he made was he thought that was a good law. He said, let them Wall Street millionaires pay that. never dreaming how it was going to grow to where it's just about getting everybody, see? And I think for the time he was a level-headed, clear-thinking person, but you just see how it goes. Along that same line, I'd like to mention this. When Roosevelt was elected, you know, our national debt was something over $17
billion. Uh-huh.
And you remember, I don't know if you remember how tremendously hard the times were money-wise. Here you could hire all the people you wanted for 50 cents a day and dinner, and it was a problem to get the 50 cents to get, see?
Yeah.
And anyway, when he asked Congress for $1 billion or $2 for relief work, one way and another, the newspapers, almost without exception, and by then, of course, we did have radios, the radio commentators criticized him severely for sinking us in debt, deeper. And every time he'd spend that money and come back, I say he, I'd mean the administration, of course, when he spent that, they'd give him some more. And the criticism went on. And the public national debt growing more and more and more until about sometime before the war started, the Second World War, I remember in one occasion he asked for $50 billion at a whack, and by then the people, the nation, had gotten used to it, seeing this debt grow and grow, and it didn't create a ripple. And now, no one knows exactly where it is, and I think that's the root of our inflation right now, is our national debt. I think if you trace it back to the root of it. And the people, I remember when Roosevelt was spending the money before the war, and listening to these radio commentators and reading in the newspapers, and I was concerned, like nearly everybody was at the time, about seeing that national debt get higher and higher. And I asked a neighbor that was considerably older than I and a very well-educated, and I always felt like a very, very smart man, how he figured we was going to pay that money back. See? And he hesitated a moment, and he said, well, he says, I don't know. But he says, as long as the old printing press don't break down, he says, don't worry. And how true it's been, but of course that saying printing press, what he meant was as long as the people would take paper money, except paper money credit.
And at that time, at least it was silver certificates.
Yes,
right.
We used to, and I still blame the labor unions for a lot of our inflation, but back of that is the national debt. Heck, the government, if we go back to cheap price, they couldn't collect enough in taxes to even begin to pay the interest on what we owe. So, what else is the way to go? But the bad part of it is, it seems like the government realized that and continues deficit spending deeper. And I think also it's probably the root of the trouble why our dollar is people getting scared of it.
We have a young couple of friends who own 80 acres of land up in British Columbia. And he told us Sunday before last, they sent a check up there for $100 to pay the taxes. And they sent it back and told him he had to have more money. It was only worth $70.
He hadn't had to pay for that land for a year or 2 years. He was just sick about it. He's a crop duster is what he is. Uh-huh. He makes big money when he works, but also a very dangerous job.
But just imagine, $100 American.
It seemed like that hit him between the eyes harder than anything else. It took, because he's coming home to him. See, he could see that and understand really what is meaning. Along that line, is our money still? Can we still get 12.5 Mexican dollars for one? Or I don't know. I don't either.
I haven't been down to the border. They say the prices have gone up at the border, so my guess would be in the border towns. Probably you could, but they've inflated their prices.
Well, but what I'm getting at, now in the paper is still the same, but Danielle, that fellow on the place here, he said something about that some people had been down there and they weren't getting as much as they used to. But in the paper, still coded the same, so I don't know.
Well, the paper would be the official regulation.
Well,
what was it, let's say, about 50 years ago?
Well, when I was a kid, it was 2-for-1. And I remember Mexicans dollars for one of ours. And my brother had a Mexican dollar someone gave him. And he had it for many years. And just recently, mother kept it. Well, it was kept in a little old tin box, among other curiosities we had. And he is talking some time back. He says he wondered what went with his dollar. Someone gave it to him when he was a little bitty old kid, probably before I was born. But I remember Papa or some of them talking that when I was big enough to pay any attention, that dollar, that Mexican silver dollar, was actually had more silver in it than ours had at the time. How they knew it, I don't know. But along that line, it hasn't been more than 20 years ago that along in the border towns here, quite often if you'd make change, they'd give you the 5 pesos silver and 10 pesos silver and such as that.
Mm-hmm.
In change, you know. And I remember one place, I was in a restaurant, a guy come in there with a pocket full of them 5 and $10 silver pieces. He wanted to change it at the cash register. I guess he's tired of carrying it. And the flop. It might have been in 16. No, that was
February of 15, according to newspapers.
Huh?
February of 15.
Now that's for like.
And the idea was they were going to split up the take Texas
from the Nueces this south.
Right, and give it all to Mexico.
But
and,
it must have been 14. Must have been 14. Yes, I believe it was in 1914.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that I'm pretty sure I'm right was that a neighbor that had come down here and made one crop when he heard about that plot, and he was from further back in East Texas, why, he had rented some land from my dad and also from his farm and his wife's part of the place just a mile south of here. And brother, they were going to take it on the 16th day of December, September.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's a big holiday in Mexico, just say the September, you know.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And comparable to our 4th of July. And so, lo and behold, my dad wasn't over the weekend, but he was. Anyway, this neighbor, he sold his crops for corn to my dad in the field, and he just sold right and left and got out of here before that 16th of September.
Oh.
You see? But you couldn't blame him too much because he was comparatively new down here and he couldn't talk Spanish, which is...
Well, the rumors were flying that on that day...
They would rise up and kill all the gringos, you know.
All of the Mexicans were going to uprise and kill all the gringos south of the Nueces River.
Mm-hmm.
And retake the country.
I did remember this. We were gathering corn. Of course, those days you gathered it an area at a time, you know, and pitched it in the wagon pulled by mules. And I was fairly young, not old enough to really pay much attention or have sense enough to be scared, you might say. But I do know that Papa there for a few days when we'd go to the field, and his Papa and my brother and I pulling corn, he laid his Winchester in the wagon. And that impressed me. I began to put... up until then, all the rumors going around, the Mexicans going, Mexican this and Mexican that, and the chef didn't pay no attention.
Mm-hmm.
But when he began to take his Winchester with him, I began to get a little worried. But it all blowed over, and I remember one of the neighbors over here, and like I say, we always got along well with the Mexican people. I consider them my friends, and... And later years,
right.
Very good friends. But you still have that language barrier, not so much with the young ones as the older ones.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the customs different, and so socially we do not mix a lot. I used to enjoy going to the fiesta, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd have them every year, but for many years, either in San Diego or here in Palmito Blanco or Santa Cruz or in Alice. Alice never did put on a big one as these other places. The band are playing, you know, and the little stands around little stands, and I used to enjoy it. And anyhow, during this trouble with Mexico there, that neighbors over here, it happened to be over here, Mexican people, to ask Papa if he wasn't scared, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Papa saying this, telling him, of course, all this in Spanish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he says, yes, he says, you all could rise up and kill me and Foster and Little and Fitzsimmons. I was about the only gringos around here. He says, but if you do in 3 days, there won't be a house left in Palmito Blanco. Maybe he was trying to scare them a little bit. I don't know. But anyway, they probably, any amount of them, had no more idea of doing anything than we did.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them blamed politicians, had the people stirred up.
But there
and scared
used to be bandit raids.
Well,
I think there was one, actually a little war at a ranch down here in the valley.
Oh, yes, along the border.
By the way, have you searched the old copies of the Alice papers that they have at the library?
I've gone through some of them. I haven't gone
through... They're photostatted, and you run them
right.
to a...
I want to tell you this. I think it might do some good if this is ever played anymore. It impressed me deeply. You see, this used to be part of Nueces County.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I was born in Nueces and born right down there, like I say, close to the cow pens. And when this county was organized, I don't know if it is 1911 or 12 or somewhere right in there, and why it was cut off, I don't know. I was too small, but I do know this, that on a certain day, there was a big celebration when they was going to lay the cornerstone for the courthouse. And we went into the celebration in a buggy, of course, and the walls were up about as high as the ceiling there. And so there were speeches and bands of playing and this, that, and the other. And out on the southwest side of where they was going to lay the cornerstone, but in the same city block, there was a tent up. And the seats, or the sides of the tent, were rolled up and seats made around it out of a 1x12. There you could go and buy refreshments. Soda pops and such as that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Coca-Cola got started then or not. but anyway, that's where I spent most of my time, because that rock didn't mean anything to me. Still, I don't know what the item of cornerstone is, but anyhow, it's on land. And so, that's where I spent most of my time that day, and I don't know how many Mexican people I saw come up there. Some that I knew, well-respected, tax-paying citizens, and that's gum. They tell them we don't serve no Mexicans.
Where was this?
St. Alice. Yeah.
And what year was this?
Then about 1911 or 12.
Well, oh, I tell you.
That's true. Now, that's what I'm leading to. Now, I'll go a little bit further with the story. Even though I was just a little old kid, I could see the injustice of it.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad, and I remember Mr. Skidmore was another one talking about how horrid that thing they was pulling there. Mr. Skidmore was an old-time ranch in the country, and of course, Dad had been here. And we, having been raised here, and you see, most of the time at school, my brother and sister and I were the only Anglos there. The rest were all Mexicans. And I want to mention this, too, before I go on further with the politics. I'd give a flat $100 right now if I could have a 15-minute movie of our school that we attended, and of the kids when we were in there, all the grades for one teacher. And in the fall when it started, there was nearly every year there'd be over 100 kids start for one teacher, all in one room. And more than once, in the winter time, we moved our desks outside on the south side of that lumber building and built a fire on the ground. And the teacher would try to hold classes there because we either didn't have a stove on the inside of it, of course, if we'd had one, it was a wood stove, or didn't have pipes for the stove.
Or no wood.
And but no, the wood, we could rustle that somewhere or another, but we just simply didn't have it. And behind her back, while she was trying to hold classes there, first one and then another different class, we'd be playing marbles, you know. And our drinking water, we carried it in a bucket, part of the time about 400 yards, and one bucket for all of us, of course. And then, because that water was a little bit salty, but actually drinkable, but we would complain about it and let us go off a half a mile down school. And sometimes we'd make it up when we got back pretty close to the school with a bucket of water, we'd stump our toe and spill it all so we'd get to go back again. And, oh, we did have a half gutters on the old lumber building. And a typist sister was named Indy, and there was always a bunch of sparrows around there, and the little Dickenses would nest in them gutters, and some of the rain they'd all wash in that water and taste, well, it tastes bad. and of course, the outside we had the chick shells, you know, and man alive, I'll tell you. I think Now, I wanted to inject this thought in my opinion. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't advocate anything as crude as we had, nothing like that, but I think we've gone just as far to the extremes in the opposite direction. I believe that.
And turning out kids.
And now, another thing about it, I've often thought about this. If any of my schoolmates, if ever was one of them in jail, I didn't know it, let alone going to the penitentiary. Of course, none of us ever become president either. But all in all, oh, of course, that was very crude, even for those days.
Where was the school?
Right over there, probably 2 miles.
Michael, oh, I see.
2 miles.
See, the little village is right through here.
Later, there's now, I believe, three beer joints and one store there, and still a cotton gin, but it was built many years later.
Well, I was going to say, what made Polito Blanco come there?
I never have been able to find out for sure, even from the old timers. Polito Blanco, you know, it really means a little white stick, and it also means a hackberry tree. Now, I don't know which. It must probably was named after a hackberry tree, a pile of life, you know. But just how come it to get started, I've asked a lot of the old-timers. No one seems to know.
It just grew.
But you see, the economy back there in those days was mostly this. Cotton, you see, was king.
I see.
And most of these people that were there were descendants of the old, if there was pioneers in this country, it was the Mexicans, see? They were here first, the Mexican people. And one way and another, nearly all of them that had land, it is handed down from forefathers, see? And, for instance, this place here, it was part of a Spanish grant. My dad bought it in 1902 for $1.69 an acre, see? Well, and the man that sold it to him, so I was told, and I knew him well later, uh-huh. Of course, I wasn't even born then. He put up a store with the money and went broke in 1 year's time through credit. In those days, Mexicans are the biggest hearted people in the world, I guess, used to be, and towards crediting one another. Well, uh-huh. That mañana deal, you know. I've heard my dad say more than once, always says the Mexican will divide his last tortilla with you, which is true.
True.
Mm-hmm. You're darn right.
He'll give you the very best he has.
Free-hearted. And I've often thought in some ways at least they come a whole lot nearer being take no thought of the morrow than we do, you know.
True.
And don't worry. And so... these people, and of course among them, there was other poor Dickenses, many of them that come out of Mexico when the revolution started, you know. For instance, one that was here, he came out when the revolution started and worked around one way or another, made a living any way they could. But those that had a little piece of land, they would raise cotton and usually plant some corn, too. Because corn was I heard one of my neighbors say one time, he says, if a man's got plenty of corn, you can't starve him out. Uh-huh. So they plant corn, but that was, you might say, in a sense, the gasoline for their tractors, what I mean by that. Uh-huh. Comparatively speaking, everybody was horse and mules, you know, then the way we farmed with, and this corn was not only for the horse and mules, but for few pigs to butcher and a few chickens, see? Uh-huh. And the corn, they also, we ate a world of cornbread. My dad put up a cornmeal mill here in 1914, and we ground for the public every Friday. And people would come sometimes 30 miles in a wagon to the mill, see? He had a little 6-horsepower gasoline engine that he run it with. And he'd whang, 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 whang there all day long to maybe make $4 or $5. But you see, $4 or $5, look at it.
Yeah.
I guess, I remember one day later when we began to charge a little bit more The best day I ever had running it all day, I think I made $24 that day. That is gross, but I believe that by then we had a diesel motor. Our kerosene, I don't think the fuel was over maybe $1.50 or $2, something like that. Doubtful about money. That was big money for those days, too.
Golly, yeah.
And,
by the way, Horace's sister and Alice took the old millstones out of the mill and had the old egg clays there in high school well, some legs on them, made patio tables out of them. They're stones about this thick.
French Burr Mills.
And they one stood still in the other. They put the corn port down.
Turns.
Puts an ashtray in there, and they're as cute as they can be.
So, then the very poor that didn't have any land, their economy, a lot of it, their living, you might say, then, was in the spring, they would chop cotton, you know, thin it and chop the weeds out, and later when it made, why, they would pick it, and some of them would follow the cotton further north, you know, to get longer work, but when it got too cold, they'd come back to this general area, and then the winter, they would grub. You know what I mean when I say grub?
No.
Well, clear land with a grubbing hole. Well, you'd call it a mattox. You'd call it a mattox.
Right.
We called it a grubbing hole.
Grub the roots out.
And the poor Dickenses, you take brush like you see there yonder, you could expect to get it grubbed for about $7 or $8 an acre, and the brush burned and the wood left there. It was an existence, is all. Existence. I doubt very much if you could get a person to grub an acre right there now, or get a bunch of them to grub it for $100. I've seen them where they was grubbing there. Yeah, well,
they
call it grubbing.
Well, they're on welfare, and they don't have to earn it.
I remember my dad, and for that day and time, I think my dad was is progressive, or maybe a little more so than the average. He bought a stump puller.
Uh-huh.
He was clearing land here, this field that he put in there. And what it was a windlass with steel cables and pulleys. And you could make them triple horsepower, in other words, multiply one by three. And bringing them back. And with mules on this windlass on the top of it, you'd hook it out to the beam around there, and it'd go around and around. And you'd pull up the biggest kind of a mesquite tree with it. Oh, that gum. So when we got it, come some good rains, and when he got it, why, he's going to try a stump puller. And you had to anchor it to the biggest tree you could find. See, it was tied to it.
Right.
And in order for the beam to go around over it, that had to be cut off, you know, so the beam would pass over the top of the stump as well. Look where we're at. We got everything ready, and we went down there, just the family. And so we got out there a little piece and put our cables to a big old mesquite tree there, and the mule started around, and over she come, and by golly, it pulled roots out of the ground nearly as far as near to your car. The ground was wet. It'd come down to where they're no bigger than a lead pencil at the end.
Gee.
And you could hear them just jerking, you know, the ground would tremble as they broke. Boy, that worked fine. Well, we got that loose and hooked another one there and pulled it over the same way, and another one. And directly we were in an island before, and you could get up. You'd pull them big old trees over, you know, and the land would all be towards you, you know.
Right.
First thing, you know. You know. That thing, Brad, it cost him way over $100 for that day and time was money. And that is the only time we ever used it, just that while that evening. It worked fine, but golly, Martin, and right after that, I guess it comes some awful hard times, and you could hire men to grub this, do the same work with a, well, you probably call it a mattox. We always call it a grubbing hose. For about $7-$8 an acre, and so I remember one bunch you had grub in there, the poor Dickenses, they put a forked pole in the ground up about so high, one here and one like over there at the gate, and then a mesquite pole there, and laid more wood leaning up against it, and threw dirt on it, and they lived in there while they was grubbing. Dang. And they was glad to get a rabbit, stuff like that. And, well, I tell you, I'd gone these people that you read about on poverty in town and that and on welfare, it just makes me want to put in your throat.
Those people back in those days, you know, the welfare minimum, I think, is what, $3,800 a year? If they'd have even seen that for a family of four, they would have been hog rich.
We used to.
And they still are a lot.
What I was telling you.
They make all of that and get their food free. They're really coming up.
What I started to tell you a while ago, that it's surprising how what an important thing just first were in this country up until 1930.
That's what I hear.
Mm-hmm. My brother and I, when I was a little old kid, I started buying them, shipping them off, you know, and buying them locally, and I'd trapping myself, catch a coyote once in a while, and we'd go out with the dogs and catch possums and skunks and skin them and all such as that. And so in the winter of 1930, the Depression, you know, was just getting pretty well started. The bottom dropped out, and they never did come back worth a hoop anymore. And but back there, I think it was in World War One. I got as high as $9 for a coon hide. And now, you all from up there where you come from, that wouldn't sound like much, because up there, furs was really, really high priced, I know, at the same time.
Right.
Because it's a whole lot more fur, better quality. Because as far south as we were, well, they couldn't compare with up there where they grew so much better pelts. And so a person at the time, you see, if he was a pretty good trapper, he could make more money and not work half as hard as he would be working for somebody at 6 bits a day all day, stuff like that. But they never did come back anymore. And I believe that was the winter of 30, that my brother and I, we was buying furs on the sideline like we'd done for years. And we noticed in the price list it was coated a lot cheaper than what they had been. So we cut our price. But also, at the time, they passed a law that a person that bought and sold had to have license. And locally, no place to get it. So the county clerk, after several months, he did manage to get us our license so that we could sell them. And by then, we had a smokehouse full of pelts out there. Coyotes and skunks and possums and this and the other. And so I remember a shipment of 90 coyote pelts, we call them furs, in one package. We sent them to Mineral Wells, and we had given, I think, about 6 bits a piece for them, 65 cents, stuff like that. And so they wrote back and told us, they said they couldn't pay but 2 bits a piece for them. And we wrote him a letter and told him, well, it said, forward him on to St. Louis, where there's a lot of fur companies. I forget what company we
were. Austin Steph. We used to get coffee.
And, but before they got our letter, they sent them back to us. So that made express charges to Mineral Wells and back here and then back to St. Louis, and we got 2 bits for them. Possums and skunks, we shipped a lot of them up there that we had, and any amount of them called fast in this long, you know. And they never did come back for a hoop anymore. But, and then during the World War II, they said that when World War II was over, Russia just flooded our markets with furs that they had been holding up. So I guess. But you know, well, in the 30s there, before the world started, I remember my brother and I bought a place down below here, and somebody had skinned a coon and left the hide nailed up on there. Well, we had a family here, and they had killed a coon on the creek and skinned it. And so I knew they had that hide, and I brought the other one to it and gave it to them. And then a very few days later, I was hauling a load of hay up the other side of Santana, the cattle, and somebody had killed two coons and left them laying by the side of the road, and it was cold weather. And as I come back, I picked up those two coons. They weren't smelling bad or nothing like that. Like I say, the night before and the weather's cold. And I brought them coons and told them, here, I said, skin these coons. And I says, I'll ship them for you, and, which I did. And I remember they got 2.5 apiece for them, them coon hides. Coons were always the highest price of any of our furs. Yeah. But that was the last coon hide I ever shipped, and that was, they got the $10.
When did you have your first car down here?
Papa bought his first Ford in 1914. And incidentally, it was the first one in Palito Blanco. And when he would go to town, about once a week, and of course your crank did, you know.
Yeah.
And he got back, and the road just wound through the brush. And I believe there was 15 gates between here and Alice. And of course you had to open each one and close it. So that's one thing that's always made everybody awful sorry if you left his gig open.
Yeah.
And when he'd get home, us kids, if any of us didn't go along, how many flats did you have, Papa? We didn't ask him if you had a flat, we'd ask him how many. And it wasn't long after that that they, well, it was a few years after that, they began to guarantee a tire for 5,000 miles, and there we all laughed about, well, I know tires could go that far. and when the weather was real cold, I wonder if you ever saw this done. Them old Model Ts would go jack up a hind wheel and put it in gear. You could crank it a lot easier. Did you ever see that done?
Yes, I did, come to think of it. Right.
Uh-huh. And I never could really understand why it was, you could crank it so much easier, but you could.
Uh-huh.
And then also, before we learned that, though, if he knew it was going to go somewhere and it was real cold weather, we'd have all the tea kettles on the stove and get the water boiling and go out there and pour it on the carpet in the and I'll never forget, I think that same year, he had a new car, of course, and I believe it was in June, or July, no, it was in June. See, all of his folks lived up the other side in San Antonio, the German community up in there, and we were going to go visit them.
I take it you're German?
Yeah, the name is, the Germans would call it Moos. I can't speak German. I wish I could. I never learned it. And I'm just part German. Actually, I don't guess there's any race under the sun that's more of a hybrid than us Americans.
That's right.
But anyway, he got an old friend that had farmed for him. A Mexican that was, that I know he later dawned on me, he'd just come as a favor to come and take care of everything while we were gone, because Papa put unlimited trust in him. And so we got everything ready to leave early the next morning. The man was here going to stay and take care of, do the chores and take care of the place. And had Mother had had packed a lunch and everything was ready and got to looking in the northwest and was lighting a little bit in there. Of course, no highways then. And Papa began to pick up his ears. And us kids, of course, we were on tins and needles. That was something for us, you know. Consider that we didn't get to go anywhere much. And no radios, no television, nothing and stuff like that. Along that line, let me interrupt. I'll never forget the first car that ever come here. The yard gate was, the yard was just about where your car is. It was a red paling fence. And the road came through there. And the fella come to see Papa in a car. I think it was a Chandler. Or a Chalmers, something like that. And I was too small. I hadn't started to school, and so was my sister. My brother, he had started. He was the oldest. And when he'd come up there and stop, well, we was peeping around the door right there and about ready to take off. This fellow, his name was DuBose, Charlie DuBose, and a well-liked, everybody liked him. He run the cotton oil mill in Alice for a long time there. And I doubt if there's a man in the whole area that everybody liked as well as him. Anyhow, he saw us kids, and I guess he sized us up pretty good.